Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Disclaimer time. This is where I tell everyone to lighten up. It's just a podcast. Trading is like that roller coaster at the amusement park. Thrilling, unpredictable, and potentially stomach churning. What works for one person might leave another clutching their hat in the wind. Our hosts and guests, they're awesome, knowledgeable, full of insights, but we're not financial advisors. So don't rush to make any investment decisions based solely on our banter. Always consult with a professional or do your own research. Plus, let's face it, we like to have fun, laugh, enjoy the trading ride together. It's all in the name of good podcasting fun. So remember, take it easy, don't bet the farm, and keep your seatbelts on at all times. Thank you for listening. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the China Shop, home of the Band of Traders podcast. I'm your host, Kyle, and joining me today, I have Mike Singleton, senior analyst and founder of Invictus Research. If you want to learn more about Mike or check out the macro research he does, you can visit InvictusResearch.com, and that's a hyphen in the middle of it. So Invictus-Research. There you go.
That's how I always say
Invictus-Research.com. There you go. I'll make sure the link's in the show notes, so that way you don't have to try to remember that. Before we kick things off, just want to remind everybody, if you have suggestions, corrections, questions for future guests, you can send that to us. Do that via email at bandoftraderspodcast@gmail.com, or you can join that free Discord server, or you can send us a DM on Twitter at financialinept1. All right, Mike, I want to say thanks for joining me today. I think I managed to hit most of the calls to action there. Was there anything else you wanted to promote before we kick things off here?
First of all, thanks for having me. And the other place you can find some of our work is at Invictus Macro on Twitter.
At Invictus Macro on Twitter. Okay, I'll make sure that's in the notes too. So let's go ahead and just start from the beginning then. Why don't you kind of tell me a little bit about yourself? Like, how'd you get interested in the markets? Where'd your journey start?
It probably started at Notre Dame, where I went to university and I studied finance. And when I was a student at Notre Dame, most high-performing finance students tended toward investment banking. Mm-hmm. But of course, the ultimate goal of investment banking was to work in investing in some capacity, right? Whether that was private equity or working for a hedge fund or something like that. And I got really, really lucky. I got the opportunity to intern at T. Rowe Price when I was a sophomore at Notre Dame, which exposed mm-hmm. me to investing from sort of a younger age than a lot of my peers. And I fell in love with it and ended up working at a small investment firm called Broad Run Investment Management out of college. And that was where I spent the first few years of my career. I was simultaneously the junior most and senior most analyst on the team, working alongside three
how does
senior
that work?
Because I was the only analyst on the team.
Yeah, how do you be the most senior and the most junior? Just you've been there the longest, but you were the youngest?
When you're the only one, you get both titles.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Okay.
Which was kind of a unique experience. And I got the opportunity to work alongside the three founding partners and portfolio managers, which was interesting because it was kind of an inverted firm structure. Usually there's more analysts and there's one portfolio manager. And at this firm, there were three portfolio managers and one analyst. So I got, I think, mentorship opportunity that was fairly unique. I certainly don't know any of my peers that were in a situation like that. So I was very grateful, had a terrific experience there. In terms of firm strategy, it was very bottom-up oriented. It was very much in style of Ben Graham and Warren Buffett and It was really more growth at a reasonable price. But the point is, it was bottom-up fundamental investing. You know, what does this company do? How do they make money? What is their competitive advantage? How is their management team incentivized? What's the growth runway in front of them? We do rigorous valuation work. And like I said, I really have no negative things to say about my experience there. The founding portfolio managers were some of the best business analysts that I've ever met. Even to this day, they're some of the best that I've ever met. That said, when I was there, I think that I learned a lot of good things. I think I also learned a lot of the limitations of rigorous bottom-up investment research. Mm-hmm. Even though it's great, it provides an invaluable service to financial markets, and you know, good investors can make a lot of money that way. I personally found that there were some shortcomings to it as well. I remember the feeling distinctly of getting my first few paychecks, and I'd pay my rent, I'd pay for my food and whatnot, and then I would put whatever I had left over in the markets. Mm-hmm. And I would go in, every day, and I would look at my brokerage account, and I would see the numbers move up and down, and I'd, that would completely determine my mood for the day. And
I remember those days.
Why are my stocks down? What's going on? I understand these companies better than anyone. Why are they not going up? Or sometimes they go up, and I wouldn't know why. Mm-hmm. And I just remember being very frustrated. That feeling of sort of not lack of control, but lack of understanding. And one of the things that I learned is that the majority of the price action, even for individual stocks, is actually not driven by the individual companies. It's driven by macroeconomic conditions, right? What's going on with the larger economy. Sometimes it's upward of 70% of the price action in individual stocks is driven by outside factors. And I think that when you're first starting out, and maybe even for senior investors as well, that's really hard to appreciate, because you sort of think, I know a lot about this stock, right? Like, I should understand what's driving the price action. This is my job. And the reality is, you can be the best fundamental analyst in the world, and there's still going to be a lot of exogenous factors impacting the portfolio of securities that you own.
Not only that, too, but you also have to, be enough people that see what you see, too, right? For your analysis to be correct.
You're relying, as a fundamental bottom-up analyst, you're relying on the market to be dumb enough to make a mistake, but smart enough to eventually correct that mistake, right?
Yes, there you go. Yeah.
Sort of a delicate balance you're trying to strike. And of course, you could also be wrong, which, no one likes to admit.
Right.
Another potential shortcoming of fundamental analysis is all the cognitive biases that you're susceptible to. When you have sort of quantitative risk management techniques for, even something just like technical analysis, you can really help, alleviate some of those cognitive biases. And, you just get out of the name, even if you've, even if it's a, an investment that you really like, hey, my risk management level is triggered amount.
Right.
And I think that's really, really helpful, because I've certainly seen some great fundamental analysts, get caught in the weeds on their name and it's down 20%. And they're like, well, it's down 20%, but it should have only been down 10%, and I'm going to start adding to it. And that can be sort of a dangerous cycle. And I've made all these mistakes myself, so I'm well aware of them.
So it sounds like then you actually do see some value in technical analysis. You're not one of those, my side is the only side kind of people. Like, there seems to be a big split between technical and fundamental traders. And I see value in both ends of it. I don't see why you wouldn't take the best of each that you yourself understand.
I think dismissing technical analysis doesn't make any sense at all, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you hear technicians say things like price is the only thing that pays all the time. And that's true, right? Like, I think if your fundamental analysis doesn't lead to better anticipating stock prices, then it's kind of pointless, right? You can go work for a university, which is great. I admire the work that academics do, but that's not your goal as an investor, right? That's not what your clients are paying you for if you're a portfolio manager or an investment analyst at a big investment firm. So, and also the way that I think about technical analysis tends to be less in terms of pattern recognition and more in terms of how do fundamental drivers get priced in and what does it look like? And also in terms of trend.
Yes.
Right. So it's less about, well, is this a triangle pattern or is this a inverse head and shoulders pattern? Although I certainly enjoy thinking about that too. That's not really the primary use case of technical analysis for me anyway.
So what is your, what aspects of it do you like to incorporate in your trading or your, I guess, I don't know if you trade personally, still with, the rigors of managing a research fund, but I imagine you want to put some money on your bets.
Right. For sure. I mean, like I said, the way that I think about it is one trend, right? If I had to choose between being a train or a trend follower, there are elements of both because, I do macroeconomic and market strategy work. And so I'm doing different statistics and I can see sometimes being a contrarian makes sense. I tend to be a trend follower. And the reason I tend to be a trend follower is because if you look at the growth cycle and the inflation cycle or even interest rates, they tend to trend, right? And so you know, the financial markets that reflect those fundamentals tend to trend as well. So if you look at the growth cycle, it tends to trend and then peak, trend and then trough, trend and then peak, trend and then trough, like the waves of the ocean over and over again. So, you know, if you're wondering why trends matter and trend following is this historically high-performing investment strategy, it's because the economy trends and then peaks and trends and then troughs, just like financial markets. And the financial markets reflect the underlying economy. Mm-hmm. So the first and most important technical factor that I consider is trend. And then we do a bunch of quantitative work at Invictus to determine when a trend is about to change. You know, what does that look like? Fundamentally, what drives a trend change? Hint, it's usually something to do with economic growth, inflation, or monetary policy. But how that gets priced in is important, right? Because, you know, if you're not paying attention to technicals, you can get run over. It's happened to me a bunch of times. And forecasting economic conditions is difficult. And if looking at the technicals can give you a heads up that economic conditions might be changing before your models do, you want to be aware of that.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that I think people get kind of hung up on, especially in like the shorter time frame traders, like the guys who are intraday mm-hmm. or maybe even like daily, I think one of the hangups that they have, though, is with discounting like macro as like being worth their time to investigate in, is that it's so hard to capture. Like, all we're used to seeing is news drops at 12, the paper hits before anybody has a chance to even digest it. It's already wiped out the stops to the low and is on its way ripping to the high. So, like, how do you capitalize on any of that? How do you trade with that kind of stuff?
It's a great question. And macro has a reputation for being esoteric, and there are also a lot of different disciplines within macro. There's sort of the event trading style, like you're talking about.
Yeah.
There's people that are mostly technical or quantitative, and they call themselves macro. Sometimes derivatives people will call themselves macro too. The type of macro that we focus on at Invictus, we call business cycle macro. Okay. So our time horizon tends to be sort of 1 to 3 years. And the reason that we say we're business cycle macro and we choose to focus on that discipline within macro is that real economic growth, inflation, and monetary policy, these three sub-cycles of the business cycle, are really what drive the vast majority of the price action over time for all of the liquid asset markets. So stocks, bonds, commodities, currencies. And then when you look at the sub-baskets within each of those asset classes, so sector and factor risks within the stock market, or the different commodity baskets like energy or base metals or precious metals, mm-hmm. or the different currencies, they all trade on these same factors. So if you get these factors right, if you get the direction, the rate of change of growth, inflation, and monetary policy right, you end up getting a lot of other stuff right too. Obviously, you won't get everything right, and there is short-term randomness in all of these markets, and there's also forecasting error, right? Because you're anticipating changes in growth and inflation, and you could be wrong. But if you get a handle on these things, it's a significant edge in terms of upside capture in a bull market, and hopefully in terms of risk management in a bear market or ahead of a bear market.
That's actually kind of fascinating. I've never heard anybody talk or factor the business cycles in more than any of the other macro things that they could look at. Like, can you talk a little bit more like how that gets utilized? Like, what sort of things are you looking for? Can you define the business cycle?
Sure. So like I said, growth and inflation and monetary policy. And I'll just focus on stocks for a second, okay, because I think this is intuitive for stocks. So if you asked a fundamental analyst what drives stock prices, the answer would be earnings, right? I think, you know,
right,
most fundamental analysts go about their job by forecasting earnings 1 to 5 years out, slapping a multiple on it and saying, this is my price target, mm-hmm. right? So everyone has sort of an intuition for that. But here's where the disconnect is. Most people don't appreciate, even if they do realize it in sort of an abstract sense, GDP, especially, you know, real GDP for whatever, let's just say GDP, tends to correlate very closely with earnings. Mm-hmm. So if it's easier to forecast GDP than it is earnings, then you should focus on GDP. And you can see the correlations look very similar over time.
Uh-huh.
Right. And so you could also break down nominal GDP into its two component parts, you know, the real part and the inflation part. And the second driver of stock prices is the multiple, right? So you have earnings and you have the multiple and you multiply them together, and that's how you get the stock price. So what drives the multiple when you're looking at it from a macro perspective? Interest rates and risk appetite. So that's where monetary policy comes in, right? So if you're getting real growth and inflation, you're going to get earnings, hopefully. And if you're getting interest rates, you're probably going to get the multiple right too. And then, you know, risk appetite generally sort of corresponds with the growth cycle. When growth is accelerating, sentiment tends to get a little frothier. Mm-hmm. But there's also an element of positioning too, right? So you'll see the equity risk premium change with, you know, how investors and hedge funds are positioned if you look at the CFTC data, but that's a smaller, less reliable relationship.
Okay. I do have one other follow-up question on that then. Back in, was it 2021, 2022, the beginning part of that, when there's the shrinking multiple quarters of shrinking GDP, did you term that as a recession?
I would say I don't think it's a recession because that's kind of an NBER title that they slap on to periods of prolonged contracting growth. Mm-hmm. And they look at four different categories of economic activity: production, income, consumption, and employment. And Generally you need to see negative numbers in all of those, but sometimes they'll make an exception. And employment tends to be the most important. And mm-hmm. employment was just too strong through that period, right? It was generally declining. We were seeing month over month payroll increases of like 300,000 or 400,000.
Right,
I don't think the NBER is ever going to declare that a recession. That said, it was a growth slowdown. And when growth slows, you know, equity markets tend to perform less well. Not always. This was really a double whammy because you saw growth slow and you saw interest rates going up really fast at the same time.
Right, right.
So you had two headwinds, and that's why you saw a 25% drawdown in stocks and 35% in the NASDAQ and, you know, 30% in the Russell or whatever it was. If you'd just seen one, it probably would have been like half that.
Right, right.
But the point is, yeah, so you saw slower earnings growth, slower nominal earnings growth, and you saw, you know, the earnings multiple contract really quickly because the Fed was hiking super fast at the same time. It was a difficult slowdown for stock investors, but I would not say it was a recession.
Okay. All right. Can we go back real quick then to, you mentioned studying in school, like you actually were able to go to school to learn all this stuff. Like that's been one of the things that I guess maybe I've been misinformed, but I thought that was been very difficult to find like good financial education at any of the, I guess, institutions in this country. What sort of things were you studying in school that helped prepare you for this job, and did it do a good job of it?
So first I'll say I was lucky I had great teachers at Notre Dame, and I'm not going to say anything negative about Notre Dame because I really liked it.
Okay, fair enough.
That said, what you just said is correct. I mean, at universities generally, it's really hard to get a practical education in markets. I remember when I was a freshman, I would go to my professors or upperclassmen and I would say, hey, how do I learn more about the economy and the relationship between the economy and financial markets? And they would all say, go read the Wall Street Journal or read Bloomberg or watch, you know, Fast Money on CNBC or whatever. And so I did all those things, and that was a really poor way to learn about the economy and markets. And I think that it probably did me a disservice. And so, you know, I really think that maybe, so right now I would say the best thing that you can do is probably open an account and start trading, at least with paper money. I mean, you can open an account with Interactive Brokers and trade with paper money in like mm-hmm. 6 hours or something, right? It's super valuable. And Interactive Brokers is a great platform. Reading books like How to Make Money in Stocks, that's a fantastic trading book by William O'Neill. Anything by Jack Schwager, I think, is fantastic. He's got a good book on technical analysis. He's got the Market Wizards book series, which is fantastic mm-hmm. if you want to know just what the mindset of great traders looks like. Something that I did was I subscribed to a lot of professional research on my own, which was, I did this when I had a job because it was kind of expensive, mm-hmm. but I would find people that I thought were smart, and then I would subscribe to their research, and I would subscribe for, you know, 6 months or a year or whatever, however long it took me to feel like I had learned their process. And it's kind of a mentorship business, right?
Yeah.
So I think if that's what it takes and you're able to do it, it's a pretty good idea. I'll also say that one of the products that we're launching at Invictus right now, it's not out yet, but we're partnering with universities using our research and an artificial intelligence enabled mobile app, like on your phone, mm-hmm. That's trained on all of our proprietary research and helps communicate it in a way that's very accessible for students.
Huh.
That's something that we're working on right now and launching. It'll probably end up being in the second semester mm-hmm. of the next school year, so Q1 of 2025. But the goal is to take that experience that I had and really improve it dramatically so that students aren't skimming from headline to headline in the Wall Street Journal. They have a resource that's more practical and more like the mentor-mentee relationship that
right.
Has really been the way things are done on Wall Street for a long time. And you can use artificial intelligence to scale that in a way that wouldn't have been possible before.
That's such a good point too, man. AI has been just such an incredible tool.
Right.
And before I get too hard on institutions too, I should point out that I think getting practical experience from any college is going to be difficult in any field you choose. And that's probably why internships are such a big part of it. Mm-hmm. Because it sounds like a lot of what you learned from your experience at Notre Dame was probably through those internships at T. Rowe and the other one you mentioned.
Right.
Was that Broad Street?
Broad Run.
Thank you.
But you're right. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And also, I got to say, I don't know if you were... That was probably about the time when I was investing in T. Rowe in my retirement accounts when I was working for CMC. That mid-cap fund that they had in the retirement accounts, man, that was a hell of a good fund and one of my favorite ones. I think still trading it.
The big asset managers like T. Rowe and Wellington and Fidelity get kind of a bad rap sometimes because people tend to look at their performance altogether. And of course, they look exactly like the market, and in aggregate, they're kind of underperforming the market. But that's just because they're so big, right? I mean, T. Rowe's like 1.5 or 1.6 trillion in AUM now. Wellington's in the same range. Fidelity is twice that size. But there are fantastic funds and tremendously talented portfolio managers at all of these places. And some of them have strategies that are not capacity constrained and still really interesting. And you just have to look for them, right? It's not as easy as just, you know, picking a random mutual fund because, you know, the law of averages says if you charge these fees, you're probably going to underperform. But there are some really great strategies. And T. Rowe had some really, really smart people. I'm grateful that I had the chance to work there.
Grateful I found them too. I mean, that mid-cap fund has done very well over the years. So tell me about the experiences with then striking out on your own. So like you worked for these other companies for multiple years. And it sounds, I would guess you probably saw a need during your experiences there, and your attempt at Invictus is probably to try to fill those needs that you identified when you were working for them.
Right. So there were a couple of things. I don't really target the same audience. So when I was working at Broadrun, which was really structured like a traditional, you know, hedge fund or asset management company, the way that I would get research was through a blast from the sales rep at Raymond James or Jefferies or Goldman Sachs or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it would be like this extremely long email with 50 different hyperlinks. And like, you'd click one and it'd be a 100-page PowerPoint. You wouldn't even look at the analyst's name. You'd have no idea who it was.
Right.
You'd be like, oh, this is kind of interesting or it's not interesting. But it was really a terrible model for research, right? Like it did a total disservice to the analyst. I've heard that most of these investment banks don't disclose their open rates to the analyst because it'll make them depressed. Huh. And
oh yeah. Yep.
Right. Like they spend all this time writing a 100-page report and, you know, 1.5% of their clients will open it. And
that's standard for pretty much anything though.
Right. Well, I don't think that they know that.
No, they don't.
I think that they would be bummed out if they saw those numbers.
Yeah.
And anyway, another thing that I noticed when I was at the firm is, like I said, I had very sort of dyed-in-the-wool value Warren Buffett type bosses at my old firm. That was their investment style. And so, you know, like Warren Buffett, they like to read the newspaper in the morning. Maybe they'd read two or three newspapers. And I think that was just kind of the standard operating procedure. And that's kind of a cultural thing with value investors is that I think that they like reading newspapers. Mm-hmm. That said, what I observed was when they were getting up to speed on a new company, when they were initiating coverage, a lot of times what they would do is they would go to YouTube first and look up whatever the company had posted about their product or service. And they would try and learn from YouTube before they would even open the 10K or the 10Q. And they do all that other stuff too. But my point is they started with video. And I thought that was really interesting because they were, you know, 40 or 50 years old. They weren't super young. They weren't video native, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the upcoming generation of people living in America, let alone investors, they're even more conditioned to consume information over video.
Right.
So what I determined after my time at Broadrun was that, hey, if I'm going to go out and start a new investment research firm, there has to be some way of differentiating the investment research because clearly there's a lot of it and I didn't like getting it the way I was getting it. Mm-hmm. So one of the value adds besides good quality research I did was delivering it over video with a professional studio, good quality lighting, good quality mic, you know, high definition, because it's a much more consumable medium for investment research. Lots of accessible charts and slides that really make whatever I'm saying, hopefully very easy to understand and very accessible. You know, if I say interest rates are declining and I think that growth should increase, I can show you a leading relationship between interest rates and growth. And it's much easier to communicate that to a client when I'm walking through it on a video than it is hidden in page 76 of some PowerPoint deck.
Right.
And so that's ended up being a very popular format with our clients. Right now, we're focused mostly on financial advisors, and you know, there are a few hedge funds and bigger firms sprinkled in, but it's mostly financial advisors and individual investors. And the next vertical that we're moving into is universities, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're building this app with the artificial intelligence tools that should make it hopefully much easier for these students to learn about markets and the economy and how they interact, and ultimately to help them place better in jobs within financial services.
I love that, man. I love that. Do you guys have a YouTube channel now? Sounds like you've already got the content to run a pretty good one.
Well, that's a good point. No YouTube channel right now. We do LinkedIn, Twitter. Twitter, for whatever reason, I'm sure you already know this, seems to be kind of a hub for financial professionals.
Yep.
And
I don't know why we still like it. I don't know. I don't like Instagram. It's too clunky for me.
It's a network effect or something.
Right.
But Twitter is probably the primary social media platform that we use. And then we use Instagram as well, but smaller following.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you should, especially if you've got old videos that you can be a good way to repurpose that and kind of get some more eyes on your stuff.
Yeah, you might be right.
Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
American Giant makes great clothing, t-shirts, jeans, and more right here in the U.S., creating jobs in towns and cities across the country. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Let's talk a little bit more then about like just utilizing macro in your trading strategies then. Let's, like, you kind of talked about some of the things that you look at, like focusing on the business cycles. One of the things that we kind of touched on before we hit the recording here was some of the stuff that you don't like to talk about. So I'm kind of curious, like, how you came about like landing on business cycles as being the thing that you pay most attention to. And then if there are other things that you do find value in or certain things that you don't find value in and why.
So, you know, like I said earlier, the reason that we focus on the business cycle is because it drives the majority of the price action. So if you're going to focus on one thing, it should be the most important thing.
Right.
And so that's kind of the way we go about thinking. And I mean, I remember when I was working at my old firm and probably toward the beginning of my tenure there, I was, you know, I was fresh out of school. I was thinking about the random walk hypothesis and sort of randomness in stock, how stocks move. And I saw a chart of the S&P 500 year over year overlaid against the ISM manufacturing PMI. Mm-hmm. And of course, they look very similar. I mean, they look almost identical. And I thought, wait, that doesn't make any sense. Why would the ISM manufacturing PMI, whatever that means, have such a close correlation with the stock market? I thought the stock market was random. And of course, the reason is the PMI is just a measure of the growth cycle, and stocks trade on the growth cycle because ultimately stocks trade on their own earnings. And so I think after seeing that chart in the back of my mind, I thought, well, first of all, I don't think that stock movements can be random anymore.
Right.
I think that there's some underlying fundamental driver that you can get your head around. And two, I think an implication of that chart is if you can anticipate the growth cycle, you can anticipate the movement of stocks. And so it probably took me a few more years from that point. But I think after making that discovery and also investing through a few cycles, I just determined it was easier for me to make money in markets, mm-hmm. investing based on sort of thematic top-down, you know, what's going on with growth, inflation, and policy, than it was to come up with a really differentiated bottom-up, you know, portfolio of ideas. It's also basically impossible to risk manage 30 or 40 individual positions without having a team of analysts underneath you. Mm-hmm. So
are you mostly trading or investing in like the SPY then? Or is that what most of your research focuses on? Or do you actually look at individual companies then within like maybe underperforming sectors or those types of things?
So I would say the latter, mm-hmm. but I would say it starts pretty top down. So I'll just sort of give an example.
Okay.
When growth is accelerating, stocks tend to perform really well. Mm-hmm. And when growth is declining, they tend to perform less well. So I'll use some round numbers here. When the ISM manufacturing PMI is accelerating, stocks tend to annualize 15 to 25% returns. When it's decelerating, it's between like 0 and 5%.
When you say accelerating, decelerating, you mean the ISM number as a whole, or do you mean just the expansion, retraction territory, or the 50% threshold?
No, I mean, it's going up or down is all I mean.
Gotcha.
So it can be going up below 50 or it can be going up above 50. It just is a line going up or down. It's really that simple.
Gotcha.
But that's a significant difference, right? 15 to 25% returns versus zero, you know, negative 5% to 10% return, right? Again, very round numbers, but that's roughly correct. So right now growth is accelerating. I expect it to continue accelerating. That means that I should be overweight equities relative to whatever my, you know, benchmark is. Mm-hmm. And we also test for different style factors and, you know, sector risks and how they perform through the various growth regimes. And this probably will not surprise anyone listening, but when growth is accelerating, more cyclical sectors tend to outperform, right? Technology, which we're obviously seeing now, industrials, financials, consumer discretionary, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. What tends to underperform? Well, the types of things that are not as exposed to a growing economy. So think utilities.
The safety ones, yeah.
Healthcare, real estate,
energy,
right? When the economy is expanding, you don't necessarily pay your utility provider more for your home electricity. You don't necessarily go to the doctor more, but you might go on another vacation.
Right.
I mean, the logic is really that simple. And the back tests bear that out very, very clearly, right? And so, you know, what's the economic regime? Do stocks perform well or do they perform poorly? What are the sectors and factor risks that tend to perform better or worse within this regime? And that's how we look for individual ideas. And then when we look at individual ideas, we're looking more at the technicals, right? So what's the trend look like? You know, what's momentum look like? You know, volume, support, resistance, that type of thing.
Do you look at any of the fundamentals of the company then too? Or is it mostly just technical at that point?
It's not just technical. I mean, we're also looking like to see insider ownership. We'd like to see insider buying, you know, like to see fast earnings growth, right? If the economy is accelerating and your company's seeing declining earnings growth,
right,
but you think the technical setup looks good, you have to sort of reconcile what's going on there. And it's possible that there is an explanation. I don't know, maybe they're making a big investment and the payback period is years out. So it's possible, but you just sort of have to be aware of what's going on there.
But you got thousands of other stocks that you can choose from. Why take the risk on one that doesn't look
right,
doesn't hit all the boxes, right?
Right, exactly. That's sort of the way we think about it is we've, you know, it's sort of like the William O'Neill style of investing, but with a macro overlay. That's the idea.
Yeah, yeah. What about things like hiring trends? Do you look at any of that kind of stuff? Like,
oh yeah,
like it's definitely a red flag if a company's having layoffs, even if they're posting like record earnings, right?
I would say we look more at hiring trends within the context of the entire economy. I mean, what you're saying is true. I wouldn't say it's a primary factor, and there are, you know, there are times when a company does do layoffs and the stock jumps, but that might be a good strategy. It's just not something that we focus on.
Gotcha. All right. What would you say to the people who think that macroeconomics is for fools and not to waste their time?
I would say that I think that there's two things I would say. One, I think they're creating a significant liability for themselves. The liability is one, you don't participate in the upside of a bull market. And I can tell you there are a lot of really bright technicians and a lot of really bright fundamental analysts that have not participated in this bull market at all, right? Stocks are up over 15% this year and they've been sitting in cash and these guys are all really, really smart. And look, I think if they tracked the macroeconomic data and they understood it, it would have given them the confidence to be fully invested in this market and to be up 15%. And for most people, if you have meaningful savings, that's a lot of money, right?
Yeah.
And then I would say on the flip side of that, you know, it can help you manage risk before a down market happens, right? So inflation was already running 6 or 7% at an annualized pace into 2022 when the Fed funds rate was at zero.
Right.
historically, the Fed generally tries to create a positive real Fed funds rate to bring inflation. So you had some idea that the Fed funds rate was going to go from zero to, you know, something above 2%, probably something above 3%, maybe above 4%. Of course, now it's above 5%. But if you were macro aware and you understood historically how the Fed thinks about monetary policy and interest rate policy relative to inflation, and you also saw that economic growth was about to slow, and that wasn't a leap. Economic growth was so fast in 2021 due to the base effects of COVID and due to the stimulus, you knew that was not going to repeat in 2022. It was not to sound cocky, it was not a difficult macro call. You had growth that you had growth that absolutely had to slow. There was no way the US could sustain 20% growth.
We had all kinds of supply chain issues during that time too. I mean,
right.
Between that and like the three, like you said, the three stimulus checks was probably the main driver of most of that growth, I would have thought.
It was an enormous contributor, right? So you had an economy that you knew with a great deal of confidence had to slow, and you had inflation running 500 or 600 basis points above the Fed's target. And you had Jerome Powell saying we're going to start tightening monetary policy in 2021. And the market didn't peak until January 3rd, 2022. So you had so much time to take risk off. Mm-hmm. And there were, again, a ton of really smart people that were too smart for macro that kept risk on, and they got absolutely clocked. And I just think that was super avoidable, right? This wasn't, this wasn't like Michael Burry digging through 900 pages of, a mortgage-backed security perspective.
Right.
This was really just understanding the basics of the business cycle. And it's almost never easy. I thought that was, in the scheme of things, a less difficult call.
Yeah.
But you don't have to be Michael Burry, right? A lot of times it's just about risk management, right? It's just about taking chips off the table on the margins or taking incrementally more risk. And that can add a ton of value if you're reasonably good at it. And you don't have to run a macro portfolio to be good at it. This is something I say all the time. Almost any investment strategy can be improved on the margins by being aware of the business cycle, right? It doesn't mean that you're, running a macro strategy. It just means that you're macro aware. And that's what we try and help our clients with.
I like that, man. I do. Do you have any good books or anything that you'd like recommend for people who want to learn more about business cycles or more about like the style that you incorporate? I know you mentioned a couple of them, like the How to Make Money and Stock Market and the Swagger books, but
it's the business cycle stuff. I find amazing how few good books there are written on this.
Sounds like another need you could fill.
Yeah, I tried to do video because I don't think people like reading books.
I still like books.
Well, there's a few people that have. I like reading books too. I mean, I really like How to Make Money in Stocks. It's not a business cycle book at all. But if you're looking to make money in stocks, it's pretty much, one of the best out there, I think.
Make sure to definitely link that one.
I like Technical Analysis of Financial Markets by John Murphy. Again, that's more technical. It's not really business cycle oriented.
Right.
The Ray Dalio books are good. I feel like that's mostly marketing material for Bridgewater, and they're really long. So you have to have a lot of patience for his marketing fluff to like really get a lot out of
right.
it, but they're pretty good. I'll have to get back to you. I will say we also have courses at Invictus, an intro to macroeconomic investing course.
That is awesome.
Where we spend about 2.5 or maybe 3 hours going through, a lot of what we've gone over on this podcast, but in more detail with more back tests, why do growth and inflation and monetary policy matter? How do you anticipate trends in these things? How do the various financial markets tend to react? And so I think that's a good resource. I'm pitching my own book, but the reason that I created that course is because I felt like there weren't any resources out there for that sort of thing.
Now's the time to pitch it, right?
Yeah. I will say Intermarket Analysis by John Murphy, another John Murphy book. He tries to connect the dots between macroeconomics and technical analysis. And I thought that was really good.
Oh, I love that. What was the name of that one?
Intermarket Technical Analysis.
Intermarket Technical Analysis. Got it. I'll make sure that one definitely gets linked. I'll probably be buying that one.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah, why limit yourself to one side or the other? That's the thing I never understood. Like, there's useful things in just about everything. And the markets are such an just incredible opportunity to where people can make money in so many different ways.
It drives me crazy.
And you kind of talked a little bit about it yourself. Like, when you studied from some really successful people, but their style didn't work for you. Like, there's things that you had to take from them that ultimately became your own style, right? Like, they wouldn't trade the way you trade.
No.
They'd probably slap you on the wrist for some of the things you do probably, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. They're very conservative. They didn't like the idea of investing with leverage. Mm-hmm. And really, I'll give another pitch for technical analysis. investing with leverage without technical analysis is insanely hard. And in my opinion, you're just asking to blow up. I think you almost have, if you're using a discretionary investment strategy with leverage and you don't have quantitative risk management at all, I don't know how you last more than a few years. Right. I don't know how you can invest through a full cycle.
Right. That's a good point.
Well, I think we kind of hit most of the topics that I wanted to touch on. Are there any other like things that you'd say to people that want to get interested in this? Like any other advice or lessons that you've learned that you think would be very pertinent to people trying to make a living in the market?
So I think, I don't know, I can't remember if I told you this off camera, or if I said it at the beginning of the interview. I think one of the first things I would recommend if you're interested in markets is going to Interactive Brokers and opening a paper trading account.
I feel like that's worth reiterating that.
Yeah, it's worth reiterating it because I think everyone wants to invest their own money and make a bunch of money. And I think the truth is when you first start out, there's a pretty high chance that you're going to lose money.
Yes.
And you might lose money pretty quickly. And it's better to just do that with a paper trading account. And that will be time well spent. It'll be time really well spent. And just treat it like it's real money. Do it for 3 months. Do it for 6 months. You know, practice investing with leverage. Practice, you know, practice trying to anticipate risk off moves in the market. And if you underperform your benchmark or whatever, or you lose money, it couldn't matter less. The difference is when you actually start investing with real money, you'll have some training, so to speak.
Yeah.
Also, it's much easier to connect what's happening in the economy and the financial markets when you have something on the line, even if it's just a paper trading account. Because understanding these things in abstract, sometimes it doesn't stick.
Yeah.
I know Nassim Taleb said that I can't remember if he said it exactly this way, but he didn't like math until he started in finance. And he's obviously a mathematician. I think he has a PhD in math. Like he didn't enjoy it, or he couldn't like concretize it in his mind until he started trading with options and learning these, like, why does an option pricing model matter? Well, you know, it matters when you're trading options, but he didn't care until he actually started trading. And in my own life, I certainly feel that's the case. It was much easier to get invested in economics and financial market, so to speak, if I actually was invested in the financial market.
I can see that. I mean, that's why the betting world has gotten so huge. I mean, a football game's a lot more fun if you have $5 riding on it. It doesn't take much. The one thing I would caution against, though, is that it becomes very easy to only see what you want to see when you are in a position, even if it's a paper trading one. Mm-hmm. So I love the idea of starting paper trading, but I think you have to mix in some time that you're just observing without anything happening too. I think that's also very helpful.
Yeah. I think a good analogy is that if you're training to be a surgeon, you should practice with a cadaver. You should watch a successful. You should watch a successful surgeon from the viewing room, right? Mm-hmm. You should not start trying to operate on people right away.
Right. I got this. It's just a wart. I can take it off myself.
Right. Exactly. So you know, these are just different ways to protect yourself from yourself.
Yeah. Okay, well, we got a little bit more time here. I do want to ask just a couple more quick questions about analysts, and then I'll let you get back to your day. When I first started getting into the markets, I at one point developed, I think, kind of an unhealthy aversion to reading any analysts because there was the thought in my head that they were all just paid for by big money. Can you kind of talk to me like what checks and balances are in place that prevent that from happening? Like, how do we know that there aren't any ulterior motives in like the materials that we're getting from our analysts?
There are ulterior motives for sure.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
The regulators try and prevent them from becoming too destructive. But like the truth is, if you're an investor relations team at a publicly traded company or you're senior management and you know, you do a lot of business with banks, you raise capital with these banks, you do investment banking transactions with these banks, and they also cover you on behalf of investors. And the research analyst at those banks gives you says this management team is no good. Mm-hmm. Well, you're not going to do business with that bank anymore, right? It doesn't matter what regulators say. If the CEO is pissed at some analyst, he's not going to work with them. And there's nothing you can do about that.
Right.
So, right. So it doesn't matter how responsible regulators are. These conflicts of interest are always going to exist. And of course, if you're an analyst at Goldman Sachs or Raymond James, and you have a reputation for offending all of the bank's clients and having them fire you, you're going to be fired. So again, it doesn't matter that, you know, Chinese firewall exists or whatever, Dodd-Frank exists. You know, what matters is, you know, these conflicts of interest still matter. They still exist. And as you know, a buy side person at a hedge fund or a mutual fund or a retail investor or whatever, you just have to be aware that they exist. It doesn't mean that their analysis can't be very good or that they can't be right. Most of these analysts are extremely smart, and frequently they are right. But you have to understand that they do have an incentive to be bullish most of the time. And if you look at the balance of sell side ratings on any stock, on balance, they're almost always bullish. And like when they're bearish, they'll say they're neutral. They won't even say that they're bearish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Because they continue to want that company's business.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Okay.
So in my mind, you know, if I were starting a hedge fund, I would be looking for independent research providers that don't do investment banking and don't do capital markets and just focus on putting out unbiased independent research, because I think really those are the only places that those conflicts of interest don't exist.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
It doesn't mean if someone, like, if there's the axe for some name is at a bulge bracket bank, I obviously want to know what they have to say. But, you know, on balance, I would be looking more toward independent research providers.
Are there any other analysts out there that you really respect their work?
Yeah.
That you'd say you feel comfortable telling people like, yeah, their work is good. You can follow that.
Yeah. I'm biased. I think Invictus does great work. I like Renaissance Macro. They do, you know, similar type work. Fundstrat. I don't really agree with Tom Lee's rationale for a lot of things, but his work is always thought provoking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like hearing what he has to say, even though a lot of times I agree with his conclusions, but I don't agree with his logic in terms of how he gets there.
Yes. Yes.
But,
but that's useful in itself though. It just means that there's more confluence to the idea that you had.
Sure. And I also don't mind hearing people that I disagree with talk about something. I think sometimes I've been wrong and I thought, hey, Tom Lee was right about that. And, you know, I think that's great. So getting different views on things is really nice as an investor. I like Market Surge, formerly MarketSmith. This isn't really research. It's more of a data platform. But I think that the way that they visualize their different charts and graphs and stuff is great. And it makes it much easier to invest in sort of the William O'Neill style of trading, because they arrange the charts and organize them in a very digestible way so that you don't have to organize the charts yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I like Barry Bannister at Stifel. That's a bank that has conflicts of interest, and I still think that the analyst does really great work.
Yeah.
So
is he constantly pissing his boss off?
Well, he does more macroeconomic strategy, and so it's less, you know, making individual companies upset.
Yes. Okay.
But yeah, I really like his work too. There are probably a bunch more out there, but those are some of the ones that I like.
I like what I've heard from you so far. So when it comes to trying to find, like, I don't know anything about analysts, like, you know, having somebody that seems to know what they're talking about, seems to have a good head on their shoulders, giving me some ideas of people that I could follow. I'm going to take advantage of that every chance.
I think you'll like all those guys. They do great work.
Yeah. All right. Is there anything else you want to say before we wrap this thing up? Any last words of wisdom anywhere where you want to direct people to come find you?
No, not really. I'd say if you're interested in learning more about our products, Invictus-Research.com. We are launching the mobile app that I mentioned earlier, not just to university clients, but also to anyone who wants it. So,
oh, that's awesome.
The big pitch for the mobile app is it's trained on all of our proprietary research. You can use it as a chat and ask it questions. We have a glossary application, which explains all of the jargon that macroeconomists use and explains it in a very simple way. And a few other really cool tools that are going to enhance the investor learning experience quite a bit, we think. It also looks great. It was designed and built, you know, our CTO at Invictus has a PhD in artificial intelligence from the University of South Wales in Sydney.
Oh, really?
He's founded and sold businesses in the past. He's, you know, a really, really impressive guy. So this app is going to be awesome.
You know, we might need to do a follow-up with him, because I've got a ton of AI questions I'd love to ask him.
He's something of an authority on the matter. So
yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah, you have to you know, get ready for a bunch of if you think what I said was confusing, man, all of the AI code jargon and stuff it's way over my head.
When's the app supposed to launch? Do you have a date for it yet?
So the launch, I mean, I'm hoping by the end of the month. The app should be more or less done at the end of this week. But you know how these things are. Dr. Drawer is his name. He says that it's like 90% of coding is just patching glitches.
Troubleshooting bugs.
Actually, writing the original code is 10%, and then going back and patching everything is 90%. So soon, hopefully in the next month.
Okay. Let's see. I think I got the media person's contact information. I'll see her a message, and maybe we can't set up a follow-up when that does launch. Maybe we can do a little something to kind of talk about AI with him.
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right. But I think that's probably going to do it for today's episode. So I got to say thank you very much, Mike. And Shira Francisco, she's the one who reached out and actually set this up. So thank you so much for doing that. I love it when you guys find us. Let's make sure we show these guys some love. We'll visit their website, Invictus-Research.com. You can click on their other links in the show notes. Follow him at Invictus Macro on Twitter. I'll be back soon with another exciting episode, hopefully as impressive as someone's Buy the Dip calls in April. But until then, do all the things to help promote the show and have a wonderful week.
All right. Thank you, Kyle. Appreciate it.
This podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It does not constitute financial or investment advice and should not be construed as such. The hosts, guests, and contributors of this podcast are not licensed financial advisors, brokers, or professionals. Any trading or investment decisions made based on the content of this podcast are solely at the listener's discretion and risk. Trading and investing in financial markets carry inherent risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Listeners should conduct their own research and seek advice from qualified financial professionals before making any financial decisions. The views, opinions, and information shared in this podcast are those of the individual contributors and do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the podcast creators or associated organizations.
Produced by China Shop Productions.
I do have one more question about Notre Dame. Do you have any secrets or things that you can share with us about the storied school? Any cool rituals you got to take part in, or did you see the hunchback anywhere?
Oh, man. Hunchback? I didn't see any hunchbacks.
Did you meet Rudy?
There was a bell tower, though.
Yeah.
Maybe he was up there. I'm trying to think. There were some funny things that were, like, I think to an outsider would just sound weird, but I'm trying to think if I can...
If you could sell them?
I don't know. Yeah, if I can say them without sounding like a weirdo. I don't know. So the dorm rector,
mm-hmm.
So Notre Dame has same-sex dorms. And so, you know, the male dorms tend to have a reputation for being kind of fraternity-like, except that the rector of my dorm was a priest.
Oh, wow.
So you had a bunch of, you know, rambunctious 20, you know, young 20-something guys being overseen by this really pious, wonderful Holy Cross priest. And he would chaperone all of the dances and, you know, social events that were hosted by the dorm. And of course, they would always get out of hand.
Right.
And so that was always really funny, you know, and he was like the nicest man in the world. It's not really a great story, but the juxtaposition of, like,
sounds like a movie.
Yeah. A bunch of fraternity guys like drinking way too much. And then you've got this, like, this priest that, is, like, you know, so sweet and trying to encourage people to be more moderate. And of course, no one's listening to him.
Right. They're passed out on the floor.
This summer, saddle up with the only sportsbook where you can bet on horse racing, FanDuel. Right now, new customers can get a no-sweat first bet up to $500. That's right, you'll get up to $500 back in racing credit if your first horse racing bet doesn't win. With FanDuel Sportsbook, you can even watch and bet select races live right in the app. So, bet horse racing on the same app where you bet all your other favorite sports. FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Just download the app or go to FanDuel.com/horses to score your no-sweat bet up to $500. 21 plus and present in Ohio. Offer valid on first real money wager of $5 or more. Verified FD racing account required. Bonus issued in non-withdrawable racing site credit that expires 7 days after issuance. Max refund $500. Restrictions apply. See terms at racing.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.